From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, on its brand new spaceship campus in Cupertino, California, Apple unveiled its latest head-turner, the iPhone X. It costs $1,000. And unlike other iPhones, it unlocks not with a fingerprint, but with a look at your face. It's the latest rollout as Apple, Samsung, Google, and more compete for the massive global mobile phone market. This hour on Point, the great global smartphone competition and where it stands now. And we'll take a special look at the technology and implications of facial recognition. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Would you shell out $1,000 for the iPhone X, maybe more? Do you want your phone recognizing your face? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Apple, with its brand new campus, shown to the media for the first time yesterday, huge, big spaceship-looking donut there in Cupertino, and the Steve Jobs Theater nearby there on the campus. Here was the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, introducing the new iPhone X a decade after Steve Jobs unveiled the first iPhone.
10 years later, it is only fitting that we are here in this place on this day to reveal a product that will set the path for technology for the next decade.
Okay, there you go. And it does it with facial recognition. That's how you open the phone and more, unlock it and more. Here's Apple Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing, Phil Schiller, describing that.
The iPhone X, your iPhone is locked until you look at it and it recognizes you. Nothing has ever been simpler, more natural, and effortless. We call this Face ID.
Face ID, facial recognition. Joining us first today from Stanford, California, is David Pierce, senior staff writer at Wired, covering personal technology. He was at Apple's big event in Cupertino yesterday. You can link to his piece, Meet the iPhone X, Apple's new high-end handset, at our website, onpointradio.org. David Pierce, thanks so much for being with us again.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Can we just talk about the Apple Park first? We've been seeing mock-ups of this for years, and now it's there. What is it? What does it look like? Is this giant sort of oval or circle set in, it looks like a park, and kind of otherworldly?
Yeah, it really does look like a spaceship. We've spent 10 years looking at plans and photos and calling it a spaceship, and then you get there, and it's like, yep, this pretty much looks like a spaceship. And obviously, as a regular person, not an Apple executive, there are lots of places that I'm not allowed to see. But it starts with this beautiful visitor center, and they have to walk you through a gate, and there's a model of the park. It's kind of like walking into the fanciest museum you've ever been in your life.
Okay.
And then you walk up through this almost sort of idyllic hill, and there's you know, plants on the sides and trees everywhere. And then you come around the corner, and it just hits you in the face, this gigantic round building full of people walking around. And right now, they're still moving people in, so it's a little pristine and a little empty, but it's still, it's incredible. I've never seen anything quite like it.
$5 billion spaceship campus there in California. Fahad Manjos writing in the New York Times that it's beautiful, but it comes with a deliberate touch of fright. He writes, nothing here is to human scale. The overall impression is one of being overwhelmed by Apple's sheer might. It is mighty. What about the rollouts yesterday? These new phones, what, an 8, an 8 Plus, and the Apple X. We're looking at the competition. Are these world beaters?
Yeah, I think it's a really fun time right now. I think Apple made a big and maybe characteristically slightly overstated statement about how impressive and new and exciting these devices are. There was a moment during the event yesterday where Tim Cook kind of claimed that Apple had just invented 4K when 4K TVs have been out for years and years. But I think what Apple did was make really the first move it's made in a long time towards something entirely new and different, in a sense of the iPhone is no longer just for the things that you've always used an iPhone for. They have this idea about what comes next and are really pushing towards that. And that was genuinely pretty exciting.
What's the vision and what's the technology that supports it in the latest rollout?
So the broad vision is augmented reality, which is this term that's been around for a long time that basically has to do with the combination of the physical and digital world. So you can actually layer things into the world in which you live. You could, one example I've always seen is you could literally stick your email onto your fridge so that when you walk into the kitchen, you would just see your email there the way you would see a note on the fridge. Or you can play games where you're playing a shooter game and there are actually aliens invading your home. And these sorts of things have been around in science fiction and ideas for a long time. But the technology to make this stuff happen is real. And Apple is really on to the idea that you can use, for now, the cameras on your phone to let you access the world inside your phone in your own space and to let your phone see and map the world around it and then do all sorts of amazing things.
So look through your phone and you may see an alien or a dinosaur standing in your living room.
That's exactly right. Doesn't that sound great?
I guess that's not my number one use for my smartphone, but okay, let's back it up. They've got some at the lower price point, and we'll look at those, but the big one, Apple, then that X, by which they mean 10, Apple 10, $999 for the base phone. What are the features that would justify that kind of record-breaking smartphone price?
Yeah, it's tough. That is a lot of money to spend on a smartphone. The big things that Apple put into this phone are, one, the design. There's no home button. There's no space above or below the phone. It's just a screen. It's a huge, giant screen on a relatively small and wieldable phone. It's made of glass and stainless steel. It's a really lovely device.
I mean, you say huge. It's the same size, right? They just took away the lip around the edge of the phone, which makes it feel bigger. Am I right?
So the size of the screen is actually larger than the iPhone 5 Plus, the iPhone 7 Plus, which was 5.5 inches. This is 5.8 inches,
okay,
which is quite large, but the actual body of the phone is about the same size as the smaller iPhone 7, which is, I think, the phone more people would rather hold in their hand. It's a lot more sort of wieldable. And so they've finally figured out how to sort of combine these things in a way that gives you the best of both worlds.
By taking away the kind of frame around it, so it's wall-to-wall screen. It's a different kind of screen, this OLED. What, deeper, brighter, what's the impact of that?
Yeah, so basically the way that it works is instead of having to light up a pixel in order to show the color black, which essentially just means you're getting gray, it just leaves those pixels off. And so you get this much richer, deeper look to the experience, and there's all sorts of stuff that you can start to do when it's only lighting up little pieces of the screen at a time rather than having to light the whole thing all the time. That can be good for battery. It also just makes colors look better. Everything is deeper and brighter and just more immersive. I think in the long run, there's a lot of tech that Apple can exploit there, but for now, it just looks better, and it does look really good.
OLED, organic light emitting diode. They're not the first ones to roll that out. Samsung has had it, but now they've got it too. And then we come to facial recognition, and it's a little different from Samsung's, which has been out there. Apple's is infrared. All right, how's it work? How do you? You don't have a home button. You don't unlock it with your thumbprint. How do you do it?
So the idea is that basically you hold up your phone in front of your face, and as soon as it sees that you're picking it up, it emits this infrared light to illuminate your face, and then if it figures out that there's a face there, it sends out these 30,000 dots, and they map your face, basically the contours and the shapes and just every tiny little detail of your face. And then it uses a camera to map the changes of those as you move your face. So it has this sort of three-dimensional view of you, and it then can really quickly, all of this happens essentially instantaneously if it works, and then it just quickly says, okay, you are who you say you are, and in theory, by the time you're even looking at your phone, it should be most of the way to being unlocked for you.
What if I grow a mustache? What if I gain 20 pounds?
Apple says it'll work. I think anyone who has used facial recognition before is going to be deeply skeptical of that claim. I am one of those people who is skeptical of that claim. And the bigger problem has been that other people can look like you. I've had coworkers who look nothing like me trick my phones into believing that it was me on some of the newer Samsung devices. And you can hold up a picture of someone and unlock their phone on some devices. So Apple's made big claims about the fact that really, unless you have an evil twin, no one will be able to get into your phone except you. But I think that there are a lot of people who are skeptical about that.
That's because of this new infrared, as opposed to Samsung, where they found you could hold a photo of yourself up in front of the camera, at least it was said, and you could get in. But yesterday, again, Apple executive Phil Schiller saying, no, not here. What are the odds that somebody else could get in here?
One in a million, they say.
Here's the tape from California.
One in a million. The chance that a random person in the population could look at your iPhone 10 and unlock it with their face is about one in a million.
David Pierce with Wired, we haven't had a chance to test that yet, right? I mean, the 10 is not out on the market until November.
That's right. And the demos that a few people got to do, myself included yesterday, were generally impressive. It didn't work a few times, but it mostly worked, and it mostly worked really fast. But those are controlled demos, and the bigger problem is not that it doesn't work, right? Right now, you can use your thumbprint, and sometimes it doesn't work, and that's not so painful. The much, much bigger problem is if it works when it's not supposed to, and that's what I think we're really going to have to test. Apple has said that it's worked with mask makers to make sure that you can't 3D print someone's head and fool it that way, but we've talked to security researchers who are pretty sure that that'll actually work. And even that number of one in a million is one in a million totally random strangers. And I think the odds probably go way up when you get to the point of someone actively trying to copy your face. So I'm excited to test that a lot more, and definitely can't wait until I do so.
Samsung has just come out with its Note 8. I mean, there's a lot on the market. Is it clear that this is a hands-down winner, or is it a neck-and-neck competition?
I think it's very much a neck-and-neck competition. It's great for consumers that Samsung and Apple have really different ideas about the future of smartphones, but they're both doing really exciting new things, and the beauty of it is that you can buy whichever one you want. I think you'll be pretty happy.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the state of mobile phone competition today. As Apple comes out with its Apple 10 and Face ID, facial recognition, Samsung and others very much in the game as well. You can join us in this hour. What do you think? Is the world ready for a $1,000 smartphone? Are you ready for facial recognition? Not a thumbprint, not a number, but your face. What do you think of Apple 10? 8 Plus, how many smartphones have you been through at this point? And what features, what capacity do you really want? Are you an Apple loyalist, a Samsung believer? Do you shop on features, on price? Apple executive Phil Schiller yesterday at the big new spaceshipy headquarters in California said iPhone's 10's Face ID will evolve with your face.
And Face ID learns your face. Even if you change your hairstyle, you decide to put on glasses, you're wearing a hat, so you do it up any way you do it, Face ID learns your face. It learns who you are, and it adapts to you as your face changes over time. Let's say you start to grow a beard. It works in day, it works at night.
Okay, Samsung is out there as well. They had a rough go last year. The Galaxy Note 7 had design and manufacturing defects. They had some exploding batteries. I'm sure you heard about that. But at the rollout for Galaxy Note 8 last month in New York City, DJ Ko, Samsung's president of mobile communications, well, he talked about that for a moment.
Of course, none of us will ever forget what happened last year. I know I won't. But I will never forget how millions of dedicated Note loyalists stayed with us. Their passion has been a constant inspiration.
Millions of Samsung loyalists, and here he is rolling out the Galaxy Note 8.
We can deliver the largest screen that fits comfortably in your hand. We are multitasking easier, note-taking more powerful, and drawings come alive. We've transformed the S Pen from great writing tool into an incredibly efficient way to switch between tasks and harness the power of this one.
DJ Ko from Samsung, they've got their own big body of loyalists out there. David Pierce is with us from Wired. He was at the Apple announcement yesterday, joins us from Stanford, California. Aaron Pressman joins us as well right now in the studio, senior writer at Fortune, covering technology. And he's been all over this. You can link to his story. Apple's next iPhone is already facing a stronger field from Samsung, LG, and Sony, he writes in his latest piece. Aaron Pressman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Great to be here.
David Pierce says he sees Samsung and Apple, and there are others, LG, Sony, you're writing about them, but with really different visions of the future of the smartphone. Do you see that in their offerings, Aaron?
Well, right, the big difference is that Apple controls this whole ecosystem. They build the software, they build the hardware, they integrate it really close together. I think that's one of the reasons why probably their facial ID security software is probably going to work better than some of these other ones we saw before. All the other companies are mostly depending on Google for its Android software, and, you know, it's sometimes been a difficult relationship. Google's even, you know, making its own Pixel phones now. So Apple has a big advantage over these other guys.
On the other hand, this OLED screen is everybody celebrates and talks about. And who is the manufacturer for that for Apple? None other than Samsung itself.
Right. There was sort of a laugh-out-loud moment yesterday when Tim Cook started to say that this was the first time an OLED screen had been good enough to use in the iPhone. I'm sure Samsung, which makes those OLED screens, is putting pretty good ones in their products, too.
What do you feel about this $1,000 price tag?
Well, look, it's very logical if you look at any other market, like look at cars or television sets or anything where as the market develops, grows, as it matures and maybe saturates, people start to say like, oh, there is some segment of customers that is willing to pay more for the prestige or maybe they're really into gadgets. And so it makes sense to start expanding, I think, the price. You know, the famous Harvard Business School professor, Clayton Christensen, famously missed the iPhone. He thought it was going to be a failure. And later, when he looked back on it, he realized it was because he didn't understand all the functions and all the parts of life that the iPhone would touch and that it would replace laptops and computers. And so this idea that maybe as we use our smartphones for laptops more and business more, that they should cost more, I think that makes sense.
David Pierce, you're looking at both of these. I mean, last year, Apple shipped, what was it, in the holiday shopping season, 78 million smartphones. Samsung, 77.5 million. So this really is neck and neck. You say they have different visions of the future for the smartphone, David. How would you describe those visions?
Yeah, I think Apple has always been a big believer in the idea that the whole can be the sum of its parts and that you don't have to do everything and that there's some sort of ineffable excellence in Apple's way of doing things and they care more about the way that things are integrated and things are a little bit tighter and a little bit more beautiful, whereas Samsung kind of goes with the kitchen sink approach to things. The Note 8 has just absolutely every feature you can imagine in a phone.
Including a stylus, the pen you can sort of pull out and work with.
Yeah, which Steve Jobs, you know, famously hated all those years ago, but it turns out millions and millions of people love a stylus. And so I think Apple has these really clear ideas about sort of right and wrong and follows them and has gotten a bunch of people to believe them. And a lot of people buy into the same thing that Apple says about simplicity and ease of use. And there's that line Apple loves to use about how it's 1,000 no's for every yes, whereas Samsung says yes to everything. And it's really fun as a result. It can be kind of chaotic.
I mean, part of the reason for the market segmentation for this more expensive, what I'm reading here, is that Apple produces so many phones, they can, and getting the parts for these is difficult. Getting the different elements, they may not be able to find enough to roll out 77 million. So if they can only put the full complement of this new stuff in, I don't know how many they'll sell of the $1,000 phone. Maybe that's all they can source at this point, Aaron.
That's right. You know, so I think one weakness that Apple maybe felt that they were facing was that they have to make over 200 million phones a year. And what if Andy Rubin, the creator of Android, you know, he's coming up in his garage with this new Essential phone. He can start putting things in that Apple can't make 200 million of to put in iPhones. So this idea of putting a premium phone maybe is like to help them keep up with some of these more cutting edge, more expensive pieces of equipment that need to go in there.
$1,000 phone. And that's just the base phone, right? It'll go up from there if you want more memory or whatever. Wow. Leah in Mount Olive, North Carolina. Leah, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think? $1,000.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think $1,000 when you finance it out with your phone company is, what, another $10, maybe $15 a month on your phone payment? And I think most people won't notice.
So it you
I think they'll go for the prestige of the iPhone 10 and be done with it.
Just do it. Just roll it in. And yeah, very often people are doing this. David Pierce, people are doing this as part of a package with their phone service provider, and it just becomes another little bit every month. Is that what Apple's counting on?
Yeah, I think the idea that people are just going to walk into a store, plunk down $1,000, and walk out with an iPhone is true in lots of places. But in the U.S., that's just not how phone buying works. You trade in your old phone and you get money back, and mm-hmm. you finance it over 24 months. And the reality there is it winds up being a couple more dollars a month. And you are paying that full price often and then some, depending on your contract with your carrier. But Apple's really banking on the fact that it doesn't feel so bad because you're not doing it all at once.
Aaron, if Apple sort of keeps the feature list slim and elegant, and Samsung is a kitchen sink approach, throws everything in there, who goes for one over the other? Do you have a sense of who's the Apple user versus the Samsung user in the U.S. or globally?
Well, I think generally speaking, and this is a very broad generalization, right? It does depend partly on, as David said, people who sort of appreciate the simplicity and want the choices made for them versus people who are sort of looking at a feature checklist and wanting to get a lot of things. But I think also it goes back to the ecosystem. All of my kids use iPhones because all of their friends use iPhones and the mm-hmm. iMessage system and some other things that Apple does to try and lock them in. So there are a couple of reasons.
And on the price front, David, we should note, I mean, $1,000 sounds like a lot. Actually, it's $999. But I think the Samsung Galaxy Note 8 is, what, $950. So it's not as if it's much cheaper.
Yeah, we've definitely reached a point where this sort of third segment of expensive phones, as opposed to the mainstream and the cheap phones, is really entrenched. I mean, Apple did the expensive thing and went out a little bit above everybody, but it certainly won't be the last, and it really wasn't the first. You could even buy an iPhone 7 Plus with lots of storage and get pretty close to that same $1,000 number. We're not really in totally uncharted territory here.
Let's go to Terry in Lexington, Kentucky. Terry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see, Terry? What do you know?
Well, I just called in to say my wife and I both use an LG Stylo 3.
Yeah.
I think I paid $120 for each. And it's a quad-core 1.4 gig, super fast, has plenty of storage. I added 256 gigs of storage to them with a card. They work great. They're super cheap. They have a stylus. My wife previously had an iPhone 5, had no storage. It seems like to me that the low-budget phones are kind of winning the game right now.
Terry, you may be on to something. I mean, stick with us. Aaron, are people just sort of hypnotized by Apple to put down this money? If Terry can go out, $120 plus a couple of little more on some extra memory, and he's got something pretty potent there.
Right. Well, if you think about it, a lot of the things that people do on their phones, like Facebook, Snapchat, browse the web, listen to podcasts, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
All those things work no matter what your operating system is, no matter what phone you have. And I think we have definitely passed the point of good enough, where even these cheap phones, he's talking about a $120 phone, can do almost everything he wants. That part of the market is growing much more quickly than this higher end so far.
So, Terry, when your friends look over your shoulder and see your LG, are they like, why don't you have an Apple? Or do they all have LGs too and wonder, why do those other crazy people spend the big money?
I know both kinds, I guess.
Yep.
In reality, when I get home, my wife has an Apple laptop that's super powerful and crazy expensive. I stuck with the PCs, and I think I spent almost $3,000 last time, and I'm a desktop guy. But it's also super powerful. I just feel like when you're, in your car and you're looking at your phone, you don't really need a lot of power. You need your power at home when you're editing photos or videos or playing games or so on and so forth.
Yeah. Maybe on your laptop, not on your phone. Terry, really appreciate your call reminding us that there is a big spectrum of prices here, and it doesn't have to be up at that $1,000 end to have a lot of power in your hand. Alan in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Alan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to address the direction that this technology is moving in. And it is absolutely fascinating to me that we're holding more power in our hands than we sent people into space with. But I think it comes with a detrimental cost to society. All this technology is great, but I think it's driving a wedge in between personal relationships. And I think that if people are going to have to make a choice, we're either going to have to integrate this technology like the iPhone with this facial recognition technology or whatever. We're going to have to either accept it 100% or opt out of it. And it's kind of scary how much information we're paying to give these corporations.
You're saying the facial recognition tips it for you, maybe? That's just like too much to have your face so intimately mapped and known in the digital world?
Like, exactly. If you read the terms of service, they can do anything they want with this information. And we don't know if it's just facial recognition. They could be taking biometrics information. I mean, the technology's there. They admit that it's there. So why wouldn't they use it for their advantage? The terms of service says they can.
Alan, let us look at that. David Pierce, what about that carefully mapped face that they've got? And they're very proud of just how detailed it is and how singular and how knowing and how it evolves. What can they do with it?
I think it's such a terrific point, the idea that we pay all these companies lots of money to give them our data. I love that way of thinking about it. It's absolutely true. I think we are at a point right now with facial recognition, with privacy, with so many things where the technology has just so far outstripped both the regulation of it and even just our conversations about it. We've just come to accept these things because they come so fast and so excitingly that it's hard to even stop and think, do I want this in my life before it has fully, you know, immersed itself? But facial recognition in general is an equal parts exciting and absolutely horrifying prospect because you can't hide. Like we all exist in the world, and the idea that there are these cameras in our pockets and out around that are mapping our faces and see us and send data away is scary, and we should rightfully worry about that. I think the one caution I would say is I think Apple has historically been a much more prone to lean towards people's privacy on this kind of thing. And they talked a lot during the event about storing your facial features on your device. They don't leave your phone. Your information is never going to the cloud or over a server in order to map your face. It all happens on your phone. And that's really, really important. And
so it's not just shared. It's not Facebook jumping in there. Now they've got your face too. And pretty soon, I don't know, you walk into a store and Facebook starts advertising. They recognize you somehow off the house camera and they're sending you ads for the deli bar.
That's right. And there's absolutely nothing preventing Apple from changing its mind and doing that. And a lot of what we're counting on with companies like Apple or even Google or Facebook is the sort of common human decency of the people who work there to not totally, you know, take this information that we've given them and use it to harm us. But that's a dangerous thing to assume.
I think people have become pretty skeptical about common human decency being the guideline for how these things are eventually used digitally. Aaron, what about just the experience of the facial recognition? I mean, I don't know how close you've been able to look at this yet, but do I have to hold it at a certain angle to my face? Does it have to be a very direct read from the phone to my face to turn it on? And I also heard in here, or read, I think, that you can buy things just with showing your face to the camera. Is that right?
I mean, Apple has decided that its face ID is secure enough that it will be able to be used to trigger Apple Pay. So yeah, in the same way that your fingerprint in the prior mm-hmm. models could do that, you will be able to pay for things using your face. It does work, you know, at multiple angles and in the dark or in a darkened room, they're saying, because it is an infrared camera partly that's doing the work here.
Okay.
So you do have to swipe a little bit with your finger at the same time to make the phone open. So it's kind of a dual system. It won't just do it from your face alone.
I see, but it'll know that it's you. And without the home button, David, it's this upward swipe instead of pressing that home button or sort of halfway and then pause if you want to get in there and go to a certain app.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a big difference. That was one of those things that even in just a 15-minute demo in the sort of throngs of people after the event yesterday was really interesting. It's a big change. You know, a lot of people have spent many years using a phone the same way, where there's a thing at the bottom that you press, and now it's a whole different thing, and it's not nearly as obvious. I'm fascinated to see how people figure it out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the state of mobile phone competition as Apple comes out with its Apple 10 and Face ID, facial recognition, Samsung, Sony, LG, and more out there, all competing across a big range now of price points. You can get down in the 100s and have a pretty powerful little phone there. You can also spend with the new Apple X $999, $1,000 essentially, for the base product. And more than that, if you want to add on features, power. You can join us in this hour. Do you ever sit back and wonder just how much smartphones have changed our lives? And are you addicted? Are you uneasy when that phone is out of reach, losing your family at the dinner table? Where does facial recognition take us? Is it cool? Is it creepy? Is it the end of privacy? Aaron Pressman is with us, senior writer at Fortune, covering technology. He's been all over the phone competition that's out there these days. David Pierce is with us from California. He was there at Apple's new spaceshipy Apple Park campus as they rolled out the new models yesterday. Here was one of their executives there, Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing, Phil Schiller, emphasizing that the iPhone 10, its facial recognition feature, can't be tricked, he said.
The teams work hard to make sure the Face ID can easily be spoofed by things like photographs. They've even gone and worked with professional mask makers and makeup artists in Hollywood to protect against these attempts to beat Face ID.
Don't try and fool it. One in a million chance you'll pull that off, they say. We're going to hear more from Hal Hodson of The Economist on facial recognition in just a moment, but a couple more calls first. Vanessa in Truro, Massachusetts. Vanessa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I am a former iPhone user. I have gone through several generations and models of iPhones and actually purchased the last model of the iPhone 7 when it came out and could not rationalize the cost into my monthly budget. So I decided to do a little exploring and for the first time adopted an Android phone. I'm trying Project Fi, which is Google's new sort of early adopter beta version of their Wi-Fi plan, which scans a lot of different cellular networks and uses Wi-Fi where it can. And it only works with three models of phones, but my cell phone bill is now $34 a month and I own the phone for under $200. So that's made a huge difference. It's worked pretty well. There are things I do miss about the flashy iPhone and the camera quality and things like that.
Yeah.
But also being a technology teacher, I've taught integrative technology in schools for K through 12, and I now teach in college as well. There's a lot of pros to having these smartphones, and people are using them in really smart ways, which is nice to know in education. But to address one of your previous caller's comments about it creating a wedge in relationships, I think people are focusing a little bit on the negative aspects of the technology. I've also seen it enhance relationship building, and I think more so it's just really changing relationships, our relationship to ourselves and to others, in bigger ways. So,
well, a lot of it mediated through that phone. Vanessa, do you have to be near Wi-Fi for your Google phone to work or not?
No, I'm in my car right now.
Okay, we got it. Gosh, be safe, and I appreciate your call. Aaron, take us again to this. If you don't want to spend $1,000 or $700 or $650 or $600 and you want to take it down, what are the options?
Yeah, I mean, there are some companies like in Asia, Oppo, Blue, Huawei is making some low-end phones, and they are taking, yesterday's best features, yesterday's fastest chips, maybe from last year or the year before. Mm-hmm. The cameras are getting better and better and good enough. I just did want to push back a little on this idea that if you just put it in the monthly bill, no one's going to notice. A few years ago, all the phone companies stopped subsidizing our iPhone purchases. We used to pay $199.
Yeah.
Now we have to pay the full price.
Yeah.
And it is usually people divide it up over 2 years. But what happened? I thought it wasn't going to matter. I was wrong. It did matter a lot. People hold their phones a lot longer than they used to, and they get excited when that $27 a month that they paid for 2 years goes off.
Sure.
And they don't want it back.
Of course. David, do you think these new phones, not just the 10, of course, but the 8 and 8 Plus, are they enough to get people off the couch and out to get a new one?
I do think we've entered this really exciting moment where you kind of buy a phone and use it until it doesn't work for you anymore. And I think that's great. The average lifespan of a smartphone has gone way up. And I think there are lots of people, for whatever reason, right now, sort of at this moment in time, there are a lot of people who surveys and studies have shown are kind of at the end of their rope with their current phone. There are a lot of people who, you know, didn't buy the iPhone 7 a year ago or wanted a Note 7 and then couldn't get it because it caught fire and now are looking for new phones. So I think it sort of works both ways, right? There are a lot of people who need a new phone right now and are going to run for phones like these because they're very good. But on the flip side, it is true that if you bought a pretty good phone a year ago or 2 years ago, it's still a pretty good phone. And we have yet to get to this point where what you require from your phone is so fundamentally different than that the one you currently have is useless. And maybe we will get there. But for right now, my advice to everyone is use your phone until it breaks or you can't install new apps anymore and then get a new one.
I don't think augmented reality is going to pull me over the line for the $1,000 phone personally, but maybe others, you know, you want to dance with an alien in the living room, you can do it, and that's cool. David Pierce in California, Aaron Pressman right here in the studio. Please stand by. Hal Hodson joins us right now from London. He's a technology correspondent at The Economist. Lead reporter on The Economist series of facial recognition technology stories. You can link to those at our website, onpointradio.org. Its headline is Nowhere to Hide. Hal Hodson in London, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Should we be, delighted and thrilled by the expansion of facial recognition now into the palm of our hands with Samsung and Apple bringing it forward right into our smartphones, Hal?
I think that's a good first reaction. I personally am pretty excited about getting a chance to use it. I do think it's going to be pretty frictionless because that's what Apple tends to do when they install these technologies sort of 3 years later than everybody else. It just tends to work a lot better than the competition has. At least that is my experience.
But how far does it go? You in The Economist have been writing about all the ways in which facial recognition is coming into life now. American churches using it to track worshipers' attendance. In Britain, retailers using it to spot past shoplifters. In China, to identify ride-hailing drivers or even letting people pay for things in China just by smiling into a camera, I guess. Is this great?
I think this is less great. It's one thing for Apple to have a very accurate print of my face and connect that to my identity because, in general, Apple has a long tradition of not basically selling ads against my profile. Whereas as we start to move into a world where there is more cameras everywhere, more computation behind those cameras to process all those images, your face in the physical world is going to start becoming an address to send advertisements to you in the real world. So we're all familiar with the fridge or the pair of sneakers that follows you around the internet after you've already bought it, right?
Yeah.
And we probably don't really want that in the real world. Do we want sales associates coming up to us saying, hey, Mr. Hodson, I saw you bought a fridge last week. Do you want to buy a fridge this week? Obviously, they'd be a little smarter than that. But that's the kind of thing that is now completely possible, as Dave mentioned earlier.
And that would be because a camera in the store that you're not even thinking about has got your face, compares it to a database. Boom, here's Hal Hodson, and he likes double-wide fridges. And here we go.
Exactly so. And one thing that hasn't been mentioned yet on the show is that I think one of the big impacts of the iPhone having face recognition is that it's going to start to normalize the idea that your face is a way to access services. And, you know, right now, if a shop put a sign up in the window saying, hey, we're tracking your face so that we can monitor your emotional state and be sure to serve you better, I think people would be a bit freaked out by that. But over time, these things normalize. People get used to these things, and there's nothing better for normalizing than, you know, sort of the world's most famous phone having this technology inside it.
China using facial recognition on a widespread scale, from shaming jaywalkers already to allowing customers to pay for KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken orders, just by smiling. Here's Yinan Shi, an employee of the startup Megvi Technology, telling ITV News that soon customers in China won't need their wallets when they go to the shopping mall.
You can just go into the shopping mall and they will tell me, you will be interested, thing is there, and you have to go there. So I go there and just grab the things and just walk out, because you're paying with your face.
You're paying with your face. Hal Hodson, that means that they know who you are, they know what you are, where you are, they know what you have in your hands and where you're headed with it.
That is right. And China is a really interesting example, or the way that their system is set up is really interesting. They have this huge central database of faces of Chinese citizens. And this is, you know, controlled and run by the government, but they share it with companies like Megvii. And that lets them build these really accurate face recognition technologies. And it lets them match people in the real world with their sort of state identity and therefore their payment information, et cetera, et cetera. And so China is way ahead on this stuff. The closest equivalent that we have in the West to that big central database is Facebook. Obviously, Facebook is quite different from the Chinese state, and they're not going to be super excited about letting any old technology company plug into their gigantic database of faces and identities.
You've pointed out that European regulators are a lot more protective of their citizens. I mean, in Europe, your face print, if we can call it that, belongs to you. And that its use requires consent in Europe, which is much more privacy-oriented than the U.S. What about the U.S.? Who owns your face print?
It is completely unclear. There are no laws. There's a couple of laws on the books in a couple of states, in Illinois, and some really watered-down laws in Washington state. Facebook is currently going through a big lawsuit in Illinois to try and argue that you don't own your face print and they can do whatever they want with it. But in the rest of the country, I think Texas, too, has some laws on the books. But the rest of the country and at a federal level, there is nada, nothing. Your face print is just anyone's to pretty much do whatever they want with, as long as they can pull it out of a photo. So that means people with cameras on the street, that if they have access to one of these database prints and names, they can just be tracking you and really watching you move around cities without you ever knowing, without you ever consenting. And I do think that's extremely concerning.
Hal, what does Facebook want to do with your face print?
I think that's a very good question, and one that me and my fellow technology journalists will be trying to answer sort of going forward. We can make some pretty good guesses. They already do things like monitor what you buy in stores by going through things, companies called data brokers, which gather as much data as they can and then sort of move it around like a commodity to people who want to buy it. So these data brokers might buy lists of transactions from stores that are anonymized.
That doesn't require your face.
It doesn't require your face, no, but you could very easily imagine these data brokers also buying lists of faces that have been in stores and, you know, maybe what sections of the store they've been interested in. You know, if I'm hanging out in the electronics section, Facebook would be very interested to know that. And so what they will want to do is just take that face, plug it into their face recognition database and go, aha, Hal Hodson has spent the last 2 weeks wandering around electronics stores in the greater Los Angeles area. We should serve him some sweet ads from our partners and make a ton of money on this guy. And then multiply that by the 2 billion people that Facebook has access to. And it's like mind-boggling how much money they could make. I think they're not quite there yet because it's kind of terrifying. But that's kind of the broad goal.
Terrifying. That relatively benign. We're used to all kinds of intrusion, but we can also imagine lots of other ways this could go. Larry in Charlotte, North Carolina. Larry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I'm not convinced that facial recognition is something that we need. I think it's what we need to do is to protect the security of the phones, our data, and not turning the phone on and off. And another thing that I feel is that the cost is too high. Look at Apple stock. Apple stock is not a cheap stock. It's a very expensive stock. They're making money. College debt includes not only books and tuition, but the equipment that students need to be successful. And we're convincing them that they can spend only $15 a month more, another $20 a month more, add to the college debt because they need a new phone. They don't need a new phone. $10 to $15 is not the delta here. We started off with $50, then we went to $60, then we went to $70. So we keep adding $10 more a month and $15 more a month. Where did we start and where are we going?
Yeah, Larry, I appreciate that perspective very much. Aaron, let me put it to you. I mean, there's a ratio here. There's kind of, you know, there's a cost benefit, and it has evolved. People are paying, it feels anyway, many people paying more and more of their income to be technologically wired in and maybe even out front, maybe even on the frontier, if that's what the Apple iPhone 10 is going to be. How do you look at that? I mean, it's for some people, as Larry says, it's going to leave them in debt. Others, it's just incorporating more and more, deeper and deeper technology into their lives. Is this the human enhancement? Is this the course of human evolution? Is this fiscally untenable, Aaron?
Well, look, I think we've already far past the point where it's almost essential to have a smartphone. Almost, you know, if you want to get a job, if you want to be involved with your friends, if you want to go to restaurants, anything, you pretty much need a smartphone. But we have not past the realm where that is out of reach of most people. And I think the earlier caller who referenced the $125 LG phone makes a great point. Right now, that need is actually, I think, democratizing access to information. It's cheaper and easier to have a smartphone with a cheap data plan than it used to be, 10 or 20 years ago to have internet service at your house, to have a computer, which costs thousands of dollars. So I think in some ways, it's not all bad. This is a good trend. And at least so far, Apple may be trying to push the price envelope up at the top end, but there's a broad spectrum of people who can afford good phones.
David, they don't need everybody to buy a $1,000 phone. You were there yesterday. What kind of sales goals do they have? Do we have any idea for this new one, the top one, 10?
Yeah, it's honestly hard to say. I think it's very clear that Apple knows it's going to sell a lot more 8s and 8 pluses than the 10, and there have been a lot of reports that actually making them is going to be very difficult. And so even if you want to buy one, you're going to have a really hard time getting your hands on it. But Apple's been in this really funny place where for a long time, it was happy to have low market share and high margins. They didn't sell a ton of devices, but they made a lot of money on everyone, and they just existed at the top end of the market. And the sort of miraculous thing that happened with smartphones was that everybody bought the most expensive thing, which was perfect for Apple and is how Apple became the most powerful and largest company in the world. And I think what we are starting to see now is a reset of that equilibrium a little bit, where people who can pay and want to will and continue to buy the Apple products. And there are many great, cheaper things for other people, too.
Lots of options out there, even as the high-end edge is on the move with Apple's latest announcement. David Pierce was there for that announcement yesterday. Covers all this for Wired. David, thank you so much for being with us today. Terrific to have you from California.
Thanks for having me.
Hal Hodson, thinking about facial recognition for The Economist out of London. Hal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Aaron Pressman, senior writer at Fortune, with me right here in the studio doing great work. Aaron, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Good luck with your phones. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.